The Supreme Court of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Tata presiding.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Please be seated. We are here this morning in the matter of City of Sparks versus Sparks Municipal Court. This is case number 59139. Are the parties ready to proceed?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Ellis Campos Mercado of Lemons, Grundy, and Eisenberg. I'm here representing the City of Sparks and the Sparks Civil Service Commission. I would like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Very well.
This case comes before the court on the issuance of a preliminary injunction against the City of Sparks and the Civil Service Commission, in which the district judge also declared several portions of the Sparks City Charter unconstitutional. We submit that the reason we're asking the court to reverse that order for several reasons, and one of the reasons is that there was no showing of irreparable harm in order to warrant the issuance of an injunction. Just last week, this court issued an order or an opinion stating that if substantial evidence does not support the finding of irreparable harm, it's an abuse of discretion, it's arbitrary and capricious. And we think that's exactly what happened here. The district court seemed to believe that it did not need to find irreparable harm. Its focus seemed to be on language in Blackjack Bonding, which said that the court has the right to manage its internal affairs without interference by other branches. Its focus was on the phrase interference. Actually, backing up, its focus was more on what constitutes internal affairs without any reference to interference. The internal affairs, as far as the district court was concerned, was hiring, firing, salary decisions, things of that nature. And it just assumed that the civil service rules and the portions of the charter were constituting interference because they also made reference to hiring, firing, and things of that nature. However, there was never any showing that the municipal court's core constitutional functions were ever in jeopardy, that they were ever at stake, and that they were ever threatened in any way. We pointed that out to the district court in oral argument, and his view seemed to be, well, that only applies when you're talking about funding. It doesn't really apply here. So there doesn't have to be an issue as to whether or not the court has to sparingly invoke its inherent authority. We pointed out that while that might have been the case in some of the cases that were presented to the court, such as the Young case and Asperia, that's not necessarily the only time that inherent powers are invoked. In fact, one of the cases that we've cited to the court is the Halverson case, where this court talks about inherent authority and when the district judge, or in that case a chief judge, invoked it in order to address an issue it had with one of its district judges. In that case, the court talks about the limitations on inherent authority. It is not saying just because it exists you may invoke it. It says you invoke it when it's necessary, reasonable and necessary, to protect your core constitutional functions and when established methods fail. We submit that neither of those were presented in this case. There was an established method. If the municipal court believed that its core constitutional functions were being interfered with, there was never any such a showing. But that established method would have been to go through the Charter Committee to bring the issues that it had with the city charter before the legislature. That is a process. That is an established method.
Well, Ms. Mercado, assuming that the city municipal court is a court that possesses inherent authority. It is stipulated under this record, is it not, that their employees are subject to a collective bargaining agreement that was negotiated by the City of Sparks. Isn't that true?
That is true.
Then under Halverson and Harvey and Daines, why isn't that an interference of the inherent authority of the Sparks Municipal Court to supervise and govern, hire and fire and control its employees?
Because under the collective bargaining agreements, these the hiring authority, the department head, still has the authority to supervise. It still has the authority to schedule its employees. It still has the authority to do many of the things that it needs to direct its employees so that it can continue on and manage its operations.
Is your belief that the court over here, is it your belief that the court is a department?
The way that the cases read, each branch is a department. The municipal court is a department of
the court
local government.
Let's go back to the fundamental issue. What is a municipal court? What is the court?
It is a co-equal branch of local government, and that's what this court has called it.
And then is it fair to categorize it as a department?
Well, the court in cases has referred to it both as a branch and as a department. We're not minimizing that the municipal court is a judicial
branch. Well, that distinction becomes very important as we attempt to look at the outstanding case authority to come up with a reasonable interpretation of this conflict, whether it is in fact a co-equal branch of government within the context. And we understand the municipal court is a little different in terms of there's certain things that it's created by the city, but once it's created, then it's part of the judicial branch.
That's correct, Justice Cherry. Justice Douglas. The reason that it's often referred to as a department is as you look at the statutes, as you look at the charter, it's referencing departments of the city. Just as the city manager is part of the executive branch, it is a department of the city of Sparks. And that is not, again, to minimize the court is a judicial branch, the executive branch, the legislative branch. They're still departments in terms of the references. When they talk about department heads having the ability to manage their staff, that would reference the elected official of that particular branch. No different than the elected official from the city attorney's office would be the department head of that branch.
Ms. Mercado, could you address one other part? This is a rather meager record in front of the district court and in front of this court, but to clarify this union question, my understanding is that when asked if they wish to maintain their relationship over the employees, the operators' union declined. But the Sparks Police Protective Association maintained that at least the marshals were still under their collective bargaining agreement. Would one conclude from this record then that the only employees in the Sparks Municipal Court still subject to some union collective bargaining agreement were the marshals, and I think there are two of them? Is that correct?
That would have been the case, except that the marshals, there is reference in the record to the marshals indicating that they would be withdrawing from the union.
So when the district court heard this case, none of the employees of the Sparks Municipal Court were under any collective bargaining agreement.
That's correct.
Okay.
So in terms of the reason for the injunction, there doesn't appear to be any foundational basis for the injunction, and that was the concern that we had, that none of the specific provisions of the city charter were ever shown to be violative of the municipal court's ability to perform. In fact, there's reference, and I've referred to it in our briefs, of a memorandum issued by Judge McCarthy indicating that it was just now declaring, finding itself, it previously had no practical reason to declare its independent legal status, and that it had always enjoyed the good relations with the other departments.
Your argument to the district court then is confusing to me, because if the city's position is that none of the employees are covered by collective bargaining agreements, then why did the city insist or argue to the district court that the notice that was intended to be given under the order to the employees that they were no longer governed by your charter provisions and your regulations regarding hiring and firing was inappropriate.
I think that the reference, Your Honor, was to the civil servants. There's two different rights that we're dealing with here. We're dealing with the property rights of a civil servant and the contractual rights of unionized employees.
So the position that the city is advocating in the district court and here is not that the employees were governed by collective bargaining agreements, but that your civil servant ordinances apply.
That would be the civil service regulations.
Then let me pose my question that I asked earlier. If it is the case that the city municipal court is a court that has inherent authority, why are not the civil servant rules in the ordinances a violation of the separation of powers?
Because the civil service rules do not impede the court from performing its core constitutional functions. It has done so since it was enacted, I believe it was in 1975. There have always been, those employees have always been protected by civil service protections. And just because there are civil service regulations, that doesn't preclude the municipal court from being involved in the supervision of its employees. It is involved in the hiring of its employees.
They allege that they're required, for example, to fill a vacancy from another city employee who wants to transfer in.
It's not required. There is, again, an established method. However, if the court does not want a particular employee, it is free to say, I don't want that employee. No differently than it is involved in submitting any questions that it may have to interview somebody. The argument has been made that, well, we don't even get to interview them. We don't get to select the criteria. But if you look at the civil service regulations, that is not accurate. The department head, and I'm talking generally speaking, they get to say, this is our requisition for an employee. This is what we're looking for. These are the criteria that we want in them. This is what we want in an employee. And that is what the municipal court has been doing. It has not interfered with its ability to perform its core constitutional
Then why process. Does the city make a distinction between, in its ordinances and in its charter, between the judicial administrative assistant and the clerk of the court from all other employees? Apparently you concede that as to those two employees, they're not subject to civil service rules.
None of the appointed positions, whether it's from the court, in the city manager's office, in the city attorney's office, none of the appointed positions are subject to civil service. Those are people that serve at the pleasure of the appointing authority.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are those types of positions that the court has complete control over. It determines who it's going to hire. It's determined whether they're going to fire them and what they're going to do. Those are those positions that are important to the court that it has full reign over. Those are different than the line clerks that the court administrator is going to supervise. That's been the distinction with some of the cases where courts have said, you can't supervise. You know, what you're doing is violating the rights of the court, because there are outside people that are saying, we're going to supervise what you do. We're going to determine how you handle your position. And that's not true in this case. In this case, the Sparks Municipal Court has all authority to supervise its employees. It is involved in the hiring process. It is involved in the firing process. It can discipline if it wants to. If at any point the municipal court feels it is being hindered because of civil service rules or the CBA, this court has provided another method, and that's the method shown in Daines, in Young, and Asbaria, where the court says, we're going to do it because you won't give it to us. We've shown that it's reasonable and necessary for our operations, and therefore, since you won't do it, then we are going to exercise basically the judicial, the litigation.
So your position would be that if the municipal court chief judge terminated a clerk, hypothetically, and the clerk decided to challenge that termination through the civil service rules or ordinances, which would require a review and a hearing and some review of what the judge did, that is perfectly constitutional and not a violation of separation of powers.
That would be correct unless that process interfered with the court's core constitutional functions. That's the Danes case.
If the Civil Service Commission says, no, you have to retain this employee, you can't fire them, and the chief judge says, my determination is I do fire them, your view would be that the Civil Service Commission controls or the chief judge controls?
My view would be if the chief judge determines that it is both reasonable and necessary, as it was in Danes, to eliminate that person because it is interfering with the court's operations, then the chief judge has the right to eliminate that person.
Isn't that position at odds with the express language in the charter and the ordinance dealing with this subject?
Except what the court has done in this in cases that precede this is it has created an alternative method. Certainly, for example, in the Danes case, where the judge wanted to fire somebody, there was a different method, but the court said because the chief judge has shown that it is reasonable and necessary to get rid of this person in order for the court to function, then that is going to trump any established methods. And that's where the inherent authority, and Justice Hardesty, you mentioned if the court has inherent power, and we have never taken any position to the contrary. There is no question by the City of Sparks or the Civil Service Commission that the municipal court has inherent authority. This court has said that in all of the cases that it has dealt with that issue. It is a matter of when that inherent authority is invoked.
And how it's used.
And how it's used. And that's what brings us here today. What we tried to argue or persuade the district court about was that, yes, they have inherent authority, no question, but what constitutes interference? What interference was shown? And even as recently in the Halverson case, the court says, yes, you have inherent authority, but when the emergency subsides or when your core constitutional functions are no longer in jeopardy, then the inherent authority ceases. That has not been the case here. What we're seeing or what we saw and what we're concerned about is that it was invoked arbitrarily, and the concern is, does that happen each time? What we're asking this court for is guidance as to when it may be invoked. What is the scope of that authority? And I know it has said it before, when does it cease to exist? Not exist, but when does it cease? When you stop using it. And so that's one aspect of it. I mean, there are several questions that arise from this injunction that have caused great concern, and that's one of them. For example, the issue of the budget. Okay, they're saying, well, once you allocate or appropriate the budget, then we should have just give it to us in a lump sum. The concern is, okay, in this case, inherent power was invoked arbitrarily. Can the court continue to do that if it runs out of money, let's say?
Ms. Percato, I'm glad you turned to the budget question. It is really difficult from this record to understand what the dispute about the budget is and what is the separation of powers conflict over the budget. With reference to the record, could you indicate, that's the affidavits from Judge McCarthy and Judge Spoo and others, what is the fight about the budget?
I don't know. And I'll tell you why I say that. That's not a phrase I like to use, but it's something that has caused us the same question. What happened, how this came about, is that when City of Sparks says we need to reduce salaries, these are the two we're asking the court to do, the court came back and said, you can't tell us what to do, and cited to an order of this court pursuant to SB 433 that within that order there was reference to the court saying, you know, you give us a lump sum budget and then, you know, we decide how it's spent. Now, one of the distinctions we've tried to make is municipal court is not a Supreme Court. There's different issues, different laws that apply to the municipal court that do not apply to this court. And that has just been, that's all it's been, is, well, we just want to lump sum budget and you can't tell us how to.
Yeah, Mr. Mercado, excuse me, and again, I had the same concern about the budget. Did the court at any time say that they, tell the city they couldn't reduce their gross budget because of budget cuts? Because we certainly understand the city was facing fiscal issues and had to balance their budget. Was the issue the specifics, like the specific people they wanted their salaries cut or the gross amount?
In fact, Your Honor, the municipal court actually complied with that. So we don't know. That's my answer. I don't know. We don't know why this issue of the budget arose, other than they started going through the charge. They said, well, we don't like this, we don't like this. Because when the city said we need to have this reduction, the municipal court complied. And there's a memorandum in the record that identifies, yeah, we've complied with it, so it's a non-issue. So then they just turned to this court's order on SB 33, or 433, and said, well, the court says we get to decide what the lump sum budget is, so just give us a lump sum, and then we get to decide from there. That's how all this arose. There was never any issue that if they don't decide salaries, for example, that their core constitutional functions are somehow going to be impaired, or if they don't have, or they have an itemized budget, that somehow that's going to affect their ability to do their job.
Well, the Sparks Municipal Court has closed apparently for an hour a week. Is that right?
That's what we're told.
Does that not show some indication of a jeopardization of its core constitutional function?
Not if that's due to budget constraints, and that's one of the things that all courts have to submit to are the budgetary constraints of whatever government, whether it's state, municipal, or county. But that was not an issue, saying that that's the reason why we need to have a lump sum budget.
But, Council, you say that's a budgetary constraint. Whose decision is it fundamentally to make? Is it the court, or is it the city manager?
The court decides whether it's going to close or not close. The court decides how it's going to operate. But there has never been anything submitted to the city of Sparks saying, we need more money because we need to open more, an hour more. There have been several budgetary issues that have been raised throughout the city, not only with regard to closing for an hour, but also with regard to, for example, freezing positions. And that has been across the board. So it's not just a matter of the court saying, well, we have to close for an hour a day. There's nothing to indicate that if you don't do this, we have to close for an hour a day. They have never asked for any more funding, saying you have to do this or else our core constitutional functions are at issue. That's been the problem with this injunction, is there has not been any indication that the court has not been able to function in all of the years that the civil service has been in effect, that CBAs have been in effect at the
court. The city's position in this case is, we asked you to reduce your budget by a percentage, and that those reductions could be made according to the chief judge's decision or the municipal court's decision. The city was not intending to micromanage what it paid its personnel or what it spent for copy costs.
Correct. What the city did is, what they were looking at is, okay, what's probably the most expensive part of running a government? It's probably its personnel. So in their wisdom, they decided, we're going to cut personnel by 7.9%. If the municipal court had a problem with that, no differently than this court had a problem when furloughs were ordered for this court, this court issued a very detailed order saying, if we do that, this is what's going to happen. If we do that, we're going to lose our clerk. We're not going to be able to operate and efficiently run the court, administer justice. That's what the municipal court should have done. It didn't do that. All it said is, we're a separate branch. You can't tell us what to do. And so that's kind of where all of this started. So, Your Honor, I see I've got my rebuttal time left, unless there's any other questions.
Council, before you sit down, just a question on Municipal Code Section 3.020. It was in effect previously. It was changed. No one commented on the change. And the change, the prior rendition of it, basically there was an understanding about a certain exemption, and that does not seem to play based upon the code change.
And I'm sorry, Anna, which?
This is as to the power of the city manager, responsibility for the efficient administration of the affairs of the city, exercising careful supervision of the city's general affairs, enforcement of laws, control over all departments, and it was changed. And the parties agreed on the previous language, but they didn't take into consideration. This has been changed in the briefing.
I comment. I don't have any comment on that, Your Honor. I know that in terms of the city manager's authority to supervise, it stops at the courthouse door.
Well, that's not the new version. That's why I asked the question.
Well,
And it was specifically changed by the city, and that's why I raised the point.
Yeah.
They didn't exempt the courts out of that.
Well, but there are impractical... Well,
if it's not been briefed, I... Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mercado. Mr. Hall.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm Anthony Hall of the law firm of Hall and Hart, representing the respondents, the Municipal Court of Sparks. I'd like to begin by laying out what I believe is the analytical framework for this situation, because I believe that will assist the Court's analysis of the underlying facts, as well as the Court's history of cases that have been decided along these lines. In particular, I think that it will help point out the confusion that the city has with regard to the standard of what is applied here. So let's begin with what is the standard and what is the analytical framework that the court has adopted through its series of cases in examining inherent authority and constitutional authority. The first step in the analysis is actually a very straightforward one, which is it's to look at the two competing authorities that are being cited by the parties to determine what is going on. In this case, we have the city of Sparks that is asserting statutory authority and charter authority. You heard from Ms. Mercado repeatedly refer to, well, we do this because of the collective bargaining agreement. We do this because the charter provisions do this. All of their authority citations, all of their authority is either charter-based or NRS-based. Then we look at and compare what the authority being asserted by the court is. And the authority being asserted by the court is a constitutional authority. There's two types of authority. One is the express authority. The second is the inherent authority. And this is the place where the city of Sparks has its greatest confusion with regard to addressing the invocation of power. Inherent authority exists whenever the authority is necessary and reasonable to carry out core constitutional functions. That's the test for the scope of the authority, not when it can be invoked or when it stops. That's determining what is the scope of this court's authority. So what we have here in this case is constitutional inherent authority against charter provisions that were self-promulgated. And as Your Honor pointed out, they were changed to make them even more onerous on the court in the recent past. So we have constitutional authority versus statutory or charter provision authority. The second step in the analysis is, again, very straightforward. This court has said repeatedly, over and over, where you have a constitutional authority against a statutory authority, the constitutional authority prevails upon the showing of an impairment, an infringement. That's the standard that's required. It's not a requirement to show some emergency. It's not a requirement to show any of those things when we have a statute versus the Constitution. This goes back to our beginning of law school constitutional law. The Constitution trumps statutes when they're inconsistent. This is the standard that has been applied consistently by this court. And I'll go through the cases in just a moment and apply those to the facts of this case. But that's the standard. If we show an infringement, we have an unconstitutional violation.
Mr. Hall, let me ask you this. Based upon Ms. Mercado's argument, the municipal court's not a constitutional court, you know, where justice court, district court, and Supreme Court are. Therefore, it's a creature of statute in that it was created when the city was incorporated and they created municipal courts. Does that impact your analysis in any way?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't, because this court has said in numerous cases that once it's created, it has all the constitutional rights of a constitutional court, and that is both the express by its mere existence and by separation of power doctrines. So that doesn't impact the analysis at all. Once it's created, it has these constitutional rights, regardless of the fact that it was statutorily created. The last step in the analysis, Your Honor, and by the way, let me sidestep on the analysis one second, which is a point that the city did not ever argue to the contrary of, and it's, again, Hornbook law, where you have a constitutional violation. If you have an impairment of a constitutional right, that by itself meets the standard for irreparable harm. This court said it in O'Connor in 1980. Wright versus Miller says it is a matter of Hornbook law where you have a constitutional violation, that satisfies the irreparable harm standard for the injunctive part of this case. So if there's an impairment, that constitutes an unconstitutional violation. If there's an unconstitutional violation, that constitutes irreparable harm. The last step in the analysis, Your Honors, is that the Danes Court set up a standard that says if it's arbitrary and capricious invocation of authority, it's subject to judicial review. And that's the check and balance for a court invoking its authority. That is a high standard. It is not the standard cited by the court. Excuse me, not the standard cited by the city, that there has to be an emergency in order to invoke its authority. It has the inherent authority and can use it whenever it deems it's necessary, unless the use is arbitrary and capricious. Now, the facts in this case clearly establish that there's no arbitrary and capricious nature of the invocation. If you look at the affidavits of Judge McCarthy and Judge Spoo and the other portions of the record establishing their dispute, establishing that they've had to close, establishing that they couldn't hire an interpreter, and that's impacting their caseload.
Well, how do they tie the interpreter, though? I don't see these tied to any imposition by the city of Sparks on what the court wants to do in a specific way. I understand your theoretical argument, but, for example, the interpreter, that is not tied to any act or omission by the city of Sparks vis-a-vis the court. So why is that a proper underpinning for this injunction?
Well, Your Honor, there are two primary constitutional rights that are being asserted by the court in this case, and then I'll talk about and answer your question about how they are impacted by the various provisions in collective bargaining agreements. There is the right to control its own budget once it's been
And on this record, in what respect specifically did the city of Sparks get into a conflict with the municipal court over budget?
There's a number of things. I'll begin with the mischaracterization of the issue. It's not that we need to ask for more money like in Young. What we have been saying is we need to be able to have full ride and authority to reallocate our funds in order to hire the interpreter and in order not to be closed for an hour during the day and in order to monitor our own orders. So those are all established on the record. The problem is that...
And were you told that you could not do that?
Yes, Your Honor. In numerous letters to the city, we've said that, and that's the court on the record. That's what was established on the record, that these are the problems. The problem...
Mr. Hall, before you leave that point, where in the record is that identified?
Primarily,
where in the record does the city say you cannot make an allocation of your budget as part of this budget restructuring process to accommodate interpreters or the one-hour issue? Where in the record that we have does it show that?
Your Honor, where in the record, that's actually a compilation of a number of things together. It comes from my letters to Ms. Mercado, where we explained our authority and our basis for the dispute. It comes from the affidavits of Judge Spoo and Judge McCarthy, where they lay out all these different issues. Here's the complication, Your Honor, and this answers both the questions that I think will help answer it. It is the cumulative effect of all of these regulations and charter provisions and collective bargaining agreements and civil service regulations that prevent us from doing these things. It's not that we can't do it.
Let me pause you there, though, because on the collective bargaining agreement issue, I understand theoretically that that would be an imposition, but my understanding on this record is that the employees that were subject to collective bargaining are thought to be, that the unions have stepped down, and so that conflict no longer exists on this record, with the possible exception of the two marshals that are in the SPPA, correct?
Your Honor, that is partially correct. The collective bargaining agreement regarding SPPA is still in place, as of today even. They have not withdrawn their representation of those marshals. So we don't have two collective bargaining agreements imposing costs and procedures that inhibit our ability. We just have one.
And that's the SPPA with respect to two marshals. And as to that, the marshals have expressed a disinclination to continue with the union, correct?
They have.
That's our record. I mean, that's what we have.
Your Honor, let me clarify the issue there. They are still covered. We are a right-to-work state. A right-to-work state means that they can say, I'm not going to be a member and pay dues, but they are still covered by the scope of the collective bargaining agreement. So their individual choice not to be members of the union doesn't change the fact that the collective bargaining agreement is still being imposed, including its rules regarding layoffs, which is specifically one of the issues in the record in Judge McCarthy's affidavit, where it was brought up that this is another example of the collective bargaining agreements imposing both budgetary and operational things on the court.
So the imposition in vis-a-vis the unions is the CBA as it affects two marshals, correct?
Correct. As of
anything
today.
Else?
For the collective bargaining agreement, no. Okay. Then the civil service regulations impose a much broader scope of the same kind of limitations. It affects the ability to lay off. It affects the ability to change salaries. It affects the imposition of when we do overtime. It affects our ability to discipline. It does all those
things. I understand
that.
I'm just trying to firm up what the record
is. Yes, Your Honor. So we have the SBPA and we have the civil service as of the date of the hearing, and actually that's still the case right now.
And there was no evidence taken at the hearing, correct, other than argument of counsel and the affidavits?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. There were no witnesses. So it's all the arguments of counsel. Primarily it was the affidavits and other documents submitted to the court as the record.
So your reference to the record, Mr. Hall, by way of example, on Spanish language interpreter, Judge McCarthy on record J-463 at paragraph 13 points out that if the one Spanish language interpreter is unavailable, the court can't operate that day with respect to people who are in need of Spanish language interpreters.
That's correct. That's one example.
Right. But, and I appreciate the point, but the question is, where in this affidavit does the chief judge or in Judge Spoo's affidavit point out that it has been precluded by the city from reallocating portions of its budget to accommodate this problem?
Your Honor, I believe they do by the totality of the affidavits. What they say in those affidavits as it goes through is we have these rules that prevent us from doing all these things. And these Civil service rules. And this is the problem, Your Honors. The situation we're facing is a cross-pollination of regulations and budgetary requirements. You can't view them standing alone. You have to look at the whole totality of the situation. The municipal court is faced with a situation where it is being told you have to have this budget that we approve and we have control over.
Well, outside the budget, let's take up the subject of volunteers. In the record, there's some reference to the fact that the city wanted to avail itself of volunteers to process some of these, I guess it's tickets, but I'm not sure about that.
Yes, that's exactly right, Your Honor. This is just one more example of the cumulative effect and cross-pollination.
And the city advised the municipal court that it could no longer avail itself of the volunteers to process tickets.
And that impaired, and that's the direct affidavit of Judge McCarthy, that impaired their ability to do this. And they had come up with a way to try and work within the system of the civil service regulations and collective bargaining agreement that imposed all these additional costs that impair its ability to perform its function. That's the bottom line, Your Honors. If we take away...
The city goes out and tries to secure free services to assist it in performing a core function of processing tickets. The city says, or your argument is, that the civil commission rules and or directives from the city bars it from doing so. That bars it from using volunteers.
They did in this specific case. Their authority for the basis of that for the first time was revealed in their reply to this court, why they did what they did.
Yeah.
And we disagree with that because the record actually
about workers' compensation claims.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that.
The concern about workers' compensation claims.
The issue raised by the reply was that there is a regulation about it deals with exempt employees working and also volunteering for the same organization, right. Basically an FLSA kind of issue. Yeah. That was never raised, and the record establishes that they were former employees, and that's in the affidavit. I believe that's in Judge Spoo's affidavit.
Right.
So what we have, Your Honors, and this is the important point of that about this, is the court is being impaired in all of these different ways that we have pointed out. The ability to monitor it, the ability to bring in an interpreter, the ability to continue to conduct business, the ability to lay off, the ability to eliminate a position. All of those are supported.
So, Mr. Hall, to clarify your position in this case, the Sparks Municipal Court is not saying we get to give to the city council a number for our budget and you have to take it. The city's, the municipal court's position is you budgeted us this amount, you have asked us to make reductions, and we want to make the decision about how to adjust those that previous budget.
Your Honor, that's exactly correct. That's exactly correct. They're saying that we have the authority on how to do it, and their authority is impaired by the civil service regulations. It's impaired by the regulations of the collective bargaining agreement. Those are the things that are impaired, while simultaneously being told, here's how you have to do it. And that's why there is no standing alone. Is this just a budget versus control of employees' issues? What we actually have going on here is two constitutional functions being significantly impaired. It's both the ability to deal with the budget and allocate it once it is appropriated. It's also the ability, like in the case of Harvey, to handle employee situations pursuant to their own rules and regulations, to establish their own rules. Instead, the city is saying, you can't establish those. You must follow our civil service regulations. You must follow our collective bargaining agreement. And that is an impairment that is on its face unconstitutional.
Mr. Hall, do you agree that this record shows that the city municipal court said, we will make the cut you request of whatever the number was?
They indicated that they would be able to, and they indicated that they wanted to do it by a different method. That the city wanted them to cut certain people, and they wanted to do a different method. And that's part of the problem here, because the court and Ms. Mercado specifically mentioned that in their response letter back to the city, they specifically cited this court's order regarding SB 433, saying, look, we don't have to do it your way. We want to do it a different way. And that was one of the sources of the budgetary problems. The problem is you can't just divorce all these things from each other. They all relate to each other.
Well, and then did the city say you can't do it the way you want to do it?
And that's exactly, that was.
Where is that in this record?
That was in, and I can't give you a record citation, but that's in this, that's in the response that they got to their SB, their letter where they raised the issue of 433. Sorry, I can't give you a citation of the record off the top of my head. Your Honors, I want to go back again to this analytical framework because I think it's important to juxtapose the two different kinds of cases.
Mr. Hall,
yes.
The point you've just made is pretty important, and I can appreciate the fact that one wouldn't be able to seize on a point of a record immediately, but I think it important that you supplement your oral argument with that identification to the clerk of where in the record you maintain the city of Sparks refused to allow the district court, or excuse me, the Sparks Municipal Court to proceed with its budget adjustment as it proposed.
Yes, Your Honor, I will supplement that. Your Honor, the second line of cases that I think is very important here and where we get this difference between a mere imposition or mere infringement is unconstitutional and satisfies the standard. The second kind of case we have is the kind of case in Young and Howerson. And that really needs to be set aside and looked at in a different way. And the reason for that is, remember the first part of the analysis is we look at the source of authority. In this case, the city is saying it's a statutory authority versus a constitutional authority, and the Constitution trumps based upon a mere infringement. In the case of Halverson and Young, what you had is two competing constitutional authorities. Young had a constitutional authority with the legislature to appropriate money. On the other side of this, the court was saying, look, we have the constitutional inherent authority to have as much money as we need to do this core constitutional function. And the analysis the court adopted in that one is to say you get to invoke the inherent authority when it's reasonable and necessary. And so it collapsed that analysis into a reasonable and necessary analysis when it's two competing constitutional functions. That same thing was applied in Halverson. You had a judicial district court's constitutional rights competing against the constitutional rights of the chief judge. And in that case, that analysis was competing constitutional rights, and the court resolved it again with the reasonable and necessary standard. And that's where the discussion about when it may stop, how far that authority goes. It is not the same case law that talks about an impairment. And this is an extremely important point, I think, for your honors to take from the various cases, is that a mere impairment of any form by the city against the inherent or express authority of the courts is by itself unconstitutional.
This Wait court- a second, though. I mean, the legislature has the power of the purse, theoretically.
Yes.
Under our case law. And I would grant you that if they refused to allocate any money to the courts, you would have a constitutional crisis. But they do have a check and a balance to perform as well, in that, let's say the courts were going off the reservation and setting up their own legislature and starting to write their own laws and so forth. The legislature could decline to fund that, and then you would have a dispute over core constitutional function of the court system. So you can't say that it just because the court wants to do it, that that's the end of the analysis, which is what I hear you saying. You can get out from under the reasonable and necessary and all the rest of the analytical structure of the way in which the legislature is impinging on the court. But really, it can't, because that's the system of checks and balances.
No, Your Honor, I'm saying along the lines of what you're saying. I'm saying that you have to examine the core powers in competition to start with. In a situation where it's a statute versus a constitution, mere impairment is enough. On the other hand, the scenario you just gave, where it's constitutional right versus constitutional right, that reasonable and necessary standard is a high standard. The court would examine, is this necessary for the court? And as you said, they were off the reservation, creating their own legislature. That's not going to pass that test. And as a result, that's the standard by which it would be judged, if they are going too far in asserting their constitutional right as compared to another constitutional right. And that's the critical difference when we look at Young and Halverson versus the other cases where it was statutory authorities being asserted.
Like, what do you do then the next year when you come with the budget and the city council is determining the budget? And the component parts, are they just hypothetical at that point? Let's say we don't have the 7.5% cut that we have. We're not a line allocation budget, but nonetheless, there has to be some discussion of how many judges we have, how many chambers we have, how many assistants you need, and so on. And the council assesses that, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And they make an allocation that they think is reasonable, correct?
That's correct.
And what do you do when you've said, we have the right to change this as we wish? Does the budget just become purely hypothetical? How does it work the next year and the year after that?
Your Honor, it works based upon the standard principles of comity between the two branches, which is they're going to work, the court and the legislature work together to determine a budget to help determine how much to appropriate.
But inherent in doing that is some discipline brought to bear that you can't spend, I mean, it's you can't spend money lavishly on, you know, elegant chambers, say.
There's no doubt about that.
So why is that not an unconstitutional infringement in your argument, if we credit your argument?
Your Honor, it wouldn't be an unconstitutional infringement. Well, it could be. Let me approach it a different way, and that's why this analytical framework works. Let's say the court does go off the reservation and is spending money on, instead of its court staff, on lots of parties for its staff, where it is misusing that funds. We're back to my analysis of constitutional right versus constitutional right. That would be the city bringing the action in that case. The analysis applies equally. They would say, look, you're abusing it, and this court would review it on a reasonable and necessary standard. They would say, is it reasonable and necessary that you use that funds in that fashion?
But Mr. Hall, the hypothetical that Justice Pickering poses, that's what I was trying to clarify, that's not this case. This is not a case in which the municipal court is seeking its appropriation and the city is refusing to grant it or some part of it. This is a case in which the appropriation was made and there is a cut, and the issue is how to allocate the cut.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that I only bring up this other line of cases so that we can distinguish.
Oh, but I would like to extend that point.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because the case law, I think, is pretty clear. that judicial review of reasonable and necessary requires a fairly substantial record, as it did in Young and in other cases in this court and in other courts, of what it was that was reasonable and necessary and what was being interfered with. And again, I repeat, other than this general proposition that the municipal court said, we want to do this allocation differently, and the city said no, it's difficult for me to see which of the reasonable and necessary components are at issue and the court's ability to review that.
Okay, Your Honor, I'll address that and expand on that. The first point I think is very important, which is this is not a situation where we have a constitutional right versus a constitutional right battle. And so this discussion, unfortunately, is getting into the hypothetical. What we have is the assertion by the city that their charter provisions prevail over the court's constitutional rights. They are asserting that their collective bargaining agreement and civil service rules prevail over the constitutional rights with regard to how we hire an interpreter, with regard to letting us get enough people in there so that we don't have to shut down, with regard to letting us reallocate our budget to deal with the budget cut, with regard to letting us reallocate our budget so that we don't have to shut down the hour. All of those things are what's on the record. So we are not dealing with this constitutional right versus constitutional right. We're dealing with a very different situation where they're trying to use city charter provisions to trump court's constitutional inherent rights. And that's really what is at issue here, as well as the record that was established regarding each of those things I just mentioned. This is supported by this court's cases as we look through these going back in time. Blackjack bonding is a great case for this principle of when you have a constitutional right versus statutory or other rights being asserted. For example, in that case, the court specifically said, once courts are created, they have all their rights, and they're entitled to manage their internal affairs without interference. So the standard is very clear. It's a without interference standard when it's constitutional rights versus something less than constitutional rights. The court in Blackjack went on to make this point even stronger. This court said, quote, a statute that attempts to limit or destroy an inherent judicial power is unconstitutional. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. There's no additional test for whether they have the right to invoke it. It's if the statute impairs it, it is unconstitutional. That exact standard was applied over and over by this court. Asbaria is another example where that standard was applied. Asbaria was with regard to a request for overtime. And in that case, and very telling, I think, and applicable to this case, the city responded and said, look, we have to do it this way because of the Local Government Budget Act, statutory, Local Government Employee Management Relations Board Act, 288, which is also part of the issue here. And what did the court say about that? This court, in directly addressing the assertion that they have to follow these statutory provisions, specifically said, if the judge has inherent authority as to the subject, then the claims of violations of statutes, quote, are without merit. And infringement is the standard. That's all that's required to be shown when you have an infringement by a statute or an individual action upon a court inherent authority.
Well, let's take that point then and apply it to the Spanish interpreters. You're not suggesting, let's take that point and apply it to the issue involving the hiring of Spanish language interpreters. You're not suggesting that there is an ordinance or a charter provision or a civil service commission rule that prohibits the city's municipal court from hiring Spanish language interpreters, are you?
I'm suggesting that it does inhibit their ability to do just that.
But you're describing a consequence, not a specific prohibition.
No, Your Honor, I'm describing specific prohibitions. In the civil service regulations, they set up a rubric by which the court cannot consider its own applicant. It can't advertise it in the way it wants. It can't even pick its own questions for what are asked of folks in this process. In other words, what they are saying is, court, you have to follow the following rules if you want to hire someone, even though this is to carry out your core constitutional functions. You have to submit it to us, and we will say, yes, it's within the budget. Then, again, this is all the civil service, we are going to be the ones that establish the provisions of what is relevant. The only thing the court gets to do is submit what it thinks is relevant. The ultimate decision is made by the Civil Service Commission, again, overriding the inherent authority. Next, the Civil Service Commission reviews the applicants and says, here's the top 10, you have to pick from this top 10. Again, imposing upon the court's inherent authority to hire the employees it wants for that position. The only thing the court can do at that point is say, no, we don't like any of those 10. What happens then? The process circles again. They never get to go out and hire based upon their own determination, and they have to follow the civil service regulations. That is what I was talking about, the cumulative effect. You have to look at the step-by-step procedures that the Civil Service Commission is imposing on the court, and those clearly violate constitutional inherent rights. Any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Hall.
Thank you,
Ms. Mercado.
Thank you, Your Honor. There was a couple of issues that I think really do need to be addressed. One of those is that there does not have to be an emergency in order for the court to invoke its inherent authority. This court has said just the opposite of that. In fact, in Halvorsen, it talks about when the emergency subsides. The language that is used is, the inherent power should be exercised only when established methods fail or in an emergency situation. So it doesn't have to be an emergency, but established methods then would have to have failed. So it's not just a matter of invoking it because it's constitutional versus statutory, as has just been argued. Asperia is an example of that. Asperia, notwithstanding that it was constitutional versus statutory, the court used the same reasonable and necessary standard. The reasonable and necessary standard does not subside simply because you're dealing with something other than constitutional versus constitutional. It's reasonable and necessary to perform the core constitutional functions. That's what this court has said, and there's never been any question about that. The problem with the argument that has just been made is it begins with the assumption that there has been a constitutional violation. That's been the argument about irreparable harm. Well, if it's a constitutional violation, it constitutes irreparable harm. Yes, but what was the constitutional violation? How has the city of Sparks violated the Constitution? That's where we remain stuck, and that's where we were in the district court. Justice Hartsey, you asked about the memorandum by the court in which it said it is complying. Not that it was going to comply, it is complying, and it is in the record at JA 92. In a May 19th memorandum, this was just shortly after the court or the city council had said we need to reduce budgets by 7.5%. The court says, to reaffirm at the outset, the court is complying with the city's requested budget reduction, so that overriding question is not before us. They dealt with that issue, but at that point they decided, wait a minute, we're the only court that doesn't get to make its own decision, so we want to be part of that, and this is how this whole issue arose. So that tells us that there was no constitutional violation, because if it were a constitutional violation, the court would not have said, okay, we will comply. They recognized it, they dealt with it, and then we go off on this tangent.
Council asked about compliance, so was that agreed compliance, or were they still at odds in terms of how the compliance was being done?
It was simply a matter of reducing the budget by that amount. And so it wasn't a matter of how it was going to be done.
So they were no longer mandated to cut the personnel?
They were asking everybody to reduce the amount of salary.
I got that part, but I'm saying, are we still at odds as to how that was going to be accomplished, where the city was saying, you must do it this way, and the court was saying, we'll comply, but we'll do it the way we think is appropriate?
There was never an issue as to that, Your Honor. It was just a matter of, we need to cut the budget by 7.5%. And if the court decided it wasn't going to do that, it wanted to do it a different way, that issue never arose. Which brings me back to one of the questions that you had asked, Mrs. Hardy, is there anything in the record which shows that the city says we're not going to let you reallocate your budget the way you want to do it. There is nothing in the record. That would have been, I think, at the forefront of this case had that been the case. The two pieces of evidence, if you will, that were submitted in support of the preliminary injunction were Judge Spoo's affidavit, Judge McCarthy's affidavit. There's nothing in there saying we tried to allocate our budget in a certain way, and they did not let us do that. That has never been an issue. The interpreters. There has never been a requisition for an interpreter up to that point where this preliminary injunction was issued. So the city never came back and said, no, we're not going to let you hire an interpreter because we don't think you need one.
Well, counsel indicated in response to his letter to you with referencing SB 433 that that's where your response is contained about the interpreter.
Your Honor, I'm not sure what he's referring to because the only thing that has been at issue there is that the argument that they've made is once, you know, you just give us a budget, a lump sum budget, no itemization, and then we take it from there. That has been the only discourse that has gone on between me and counsel. But between the city and the court, there has never been any indication where the city says, we're not going to give you a certain amount of money, even though you're telling us that you need another interpreter. There has never been a requisition for another interpreter. The shortage of staff, there has never been a requisition.
So, Ms. Mercado, if I understand your position, once the city notified... once the municipal court notified the city that it would effectuate a 7.5% reduction, if I've got the right percentage, then the court was free to accomplish that as it saw fit.
As far as I know, yes. There was never any issue about we don't want to do it that way, we want to do it this way. It was just a matter of you're telling us what to do and we're the ones who control those two employees. But nevertheless, the municipal court complied with it. They didn't use another method.
Mm-hmm. Well, but isn't their point, may I ask?
Of course.
Isn't their point that in order to comply with the 7.5% reduction, which they did, the civil service guidelines and other burdens that the city has imposed on them made it necessary for them not to hire the additional interpreters, not to do what they feel are their core functions? I don't see that in this record, but isn't that their argument?
If that's their argument, Your Honor, there's never been any evidence to that. So I don't know. It has been general concepts of we can't do this, we can't do that. And what we've been saying is show us how, show us where. Where have you tried that it has failed? There have been no established methods that have been used, much less failed, which is why the injunction should never have issued. There are no other questions.
Thank you, Ms. Mercado. Mr. Hall?